Hey guys, Micah here. Just wanted to remind you before we get started to go to Christianity.plus in your web browser. This is our website that has show notes for all the episodes, including this latest one, including all the earlier ones. We've spent hours and hours kind of going through and putting together notes for each episode, including lots of links and resources. And while you're there, be sure to click on subscribe by email. This is where we're going to send out each new episode along with events and things of interest in the Christian transhumanist community. I'd love for you to be engaged and involved with that and part of the conversation. So thanks for listening, and let's get started. I'm here with Paul Wallace, who is a professor of physics and astronomy, a minister, and the author of the upcoming book, Stars Beneath Us, Finding God in the Evolving Cosmos. Thanks, Paul, for joining me today.
You're welcome.
So I think the thing that kind of drew me in initially was the title of the book that you've written, and this idea of Stars Beneath Us. Can you tell me about that and kind of where the title came from?
Sure, yeah. It comes from this, I'm a professor, and one of the greatest moments, it comes from an event that happened when I was teaching. One of the greatest moments that I've experienced as a teacher happened about 10 years ago. I was teaching an intro to astronomy class that I've taught any number of times, and I was talking about how many stars you can see on a clear night, you know, with good vision, unobstructed horizons. You can see about 3,000 stars. That's it. Mm-hmm. And I told the class this, and then I said, you know, and if we could take the Earth out from under our feet, we'd see about 3,000 more. So for a total of about 6,000 stars, right? And then so pretty. Modest little point I made.
Sure.
And I kept on I was going to go on talk about the constellations, but this kid about two rows back on the left had this look on his face of just it was almost like trauma on his face. And I was so put off. I actually asked him what was the problem, what had happened. And this is a 20-year-old good student in college, and he said, you just said that there were stars underneath our feet, and I've never really thought about that before. And so obviously he knew, if you had asked him on the corner, street corner that day earlier, if you'd asked him, you know, is the Earth spherical and is it surrounded by stars, he would have said yes. But I think he kind of found himself, in the cosmos that he had always imagined, but never really located himself in it. Mm-hmm. And I think he was really surprised to find himself in it and to actually sense those stars under his feet and to have this sense of almost like vertigo, you know?
Yeah.
It's like the ground under your feet that you thought was real, you know, is not quite what it looks like, you know?
Yeah.
And certainly that's the sort of thing that people felt when the Copernican theory started becoming more widely accepted. They probably had that weird sense.
Yeah.
Also. But the basic point of it is that so often science and religion books sort of take normal human life out of it, out of the books, and it becomes a head game. But I think that the missing piece oftentimes in science and religion discussions is normal human life and finding ourselves within the cosmos that we imagine. I think that we leave ourselves out of the picture sometime. Huh. And so that's kind of the angle the book takes.
Yeah, so that is interesting because, you know, when you're talking about that, I realize that, you know, I think I probably haven't thought about it quite that much either. I mean, I do have this app that kind of points out the constellations and you can kind of look down and you know, it's right. It's clear that there are stars beneath you, but despite the fact that most of us are very aware of, you know, the fact that the universe is a very big place and goes in all directions. And, it's a very different sort of sensation to really think about it being underneath your feet. And an app like that can kind of point it out. But even just the phrasing of that, I think, stands out. So how do you, that's kind of maybe a problem in these sorts of discussions is that we are, you know, it's really easy to talk about conceptually what it means to, you know, be in a universe with galaxies and star systems and all this kind of stuff. But then we have no way of kind of mapping that to our personal
experience. How do we overcome that, or how do we address that?
Well, that's part of what the book does. And I use two things in the book to connect normal human life to the cosmos. And one is my own story. It's a personal story of, I was raised in a household of scientifically literate Baptists, which is a strange combination, I guess. And so part of that is just my own story, my own life, my own wrestling with these ideas and how it has played out in my normal life. And the other part of it, I look to the biblical book of Job, because Job, you know, wanted justice. You know, Job had was a good man, best man in every sense of the word. He had suffered great loss, and he prayed to God for justice. And he didn't, you know, and when God responded, God didn't respond. He didn't diagram justice for Job. He took Job on a trip through the cosmos, right, and showed Job the earth and the sky and the animals and, you know, the very limits of the cosmos as they knew it at the time. And I think that's really interesting, that something about the cosmos spoke to Job's most human need for justice and peace in his heart. And he just, you know, and somehow the cosmos brought that to him.
Wow.
So by sort of weaving my own story in with that of Job, and that's sort of the approach I take to connect it to human, normal human life. Because everybody suffers, right? That's every day. And people usually don't connect everyday life with stuff like, you know, the stars and the farthest reaches of creation.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I hadn't really ever thought about Job in that kind of a context before, but that is how that's addressed. And it seems like, you know, the biblical answer to a lot of these kinds of questions is that sort of thing. It's to zoom out.
Yeah, right.
It's to move out into a bigger frame of reference.
And the weird thing is about it is that apparently it worked for Job, you know. Right. It worked.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. So there's sort of like a tension there, though, because, you know, as you said, telling this student in class that there are stars beneath his feet, in a way, you know, is overwhelming and disconcerting, and it can kind of introduce all kinds of negative feelings. But it's also the way that Job is brought to kind of come to terms with his own suffering and develop more positive feelings about that.
Well, there's something to be said for becoming aware that we're not the only thing in the universe. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I address this in the book, you know, we can get a little self-obsessed, you know, not only with ourselves as individuals, but with ourselves as a human race. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a little too much weight to carry sometimes, thinking that God is concerned only about us. One thing I'll tell you is that a few years ago, my little girl was really scared. She was in bed and she was afraid about something. I don't know what it was, you know, a ghost or something. I don't know. And so what I began to do is I began to talk to her about all the other animals that were going to sleep at the same time, you know, squirrels and deer and elephants and whatever. And, you know, it really worked. And I began to think about that. And I think that there's a great relief that comes from realizing that we're a small part of a big picture. And somehow zooming out does, in fact, bring a relief, and you know it dials down the self-obsession, I think.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the approach that I take.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've been focused lately and kind of with this podcast and so forth on trying to think about the role of imagination and storytelling in expanding our sense of horizon. And because I think that's important, and I hadn't thought about it in terms of how we get over suffering, but I think it's so important to a lot of what we are as human beings to be able to step back and have that bigger perspective.
Well, you certainly do that in the work that you do. You think more in terms of the future, but I think the effect might be similar.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. For me, the future is precisely a way to kind of give us a bigger perspective, because it doesn't just say, you know, here's everything that is, it says, you know, here's what's emerging, or here's what could emerge from the things that are.
Right.
And in that, I think gives, you know, in my kind of perspective of the future is it gives everything its due. You know, we see so many things in our world that are in the process of developing, and we don't know what they will turn out like. We're not sure where they will go from here. And maybe they're, you know, just, maybe they're just small efforts that we hope will develop in some way, or we hope, you know, indicate the promise of something bigger. And by extending our gaze to the future, we're able to give essentially things space to grow and to have their kind of true nature played out. So yeah, that is, I think to me, those are very similar sorts of things, is to, you know, finding a way to zoom out gives us something that's important for us as human beings. And I'm not sure what all it is, but I think it's somehow crucial.
I think so too. Yeah.
So tell me more about your personal story, because this is, you're following your personal story in the book. You grew up at, you know, in a Baptist family, but with scientific literacy. Where does that lead? How does that play out?
Well, it plays the where it played out at a pretty, I think, an earlier age for me than for most people. It played out with me asking a lot of questions pretty early on, because, you know, it struck me, and I tell this story, I think, in chapter one, it struck me pretty early on that, you know, when you find things like geologic timescales in books, we had plenty of science books around the house, you don't see Adam and Eve, you know, on that timescale, you know.
Yeah.
And you don't see, you know, stegosaurs in the Bible.
Yeah.
And, you know, trilobites in the Bible. And so I pretty early on, I began to question everything. And by the time I was probably a sophomore or junior in high school, I had begun to seriously question everything about my faith. And I got in college, I just dropped it altogether. I just completely just decided that, you know, I mean, science was so much more interesting to me. Cosmos was so much more interesting to me. You know, I became a physics major, and it just overwhelmed me with its scale and its just its intricacy and its beauty. And I was, you know, the other stuff just seemed, stuff I learned in church seemed really small and irrational and you know, irrelevant.
Yeah.
So by the time I was in college, I had basically thrown it out. I was never really angry about it. I had a really good upbringing in church. I mean, I grew up in a truly loving church and felt loved there. I don't have one of these awful horror stories about growing up in, you know, a fundamentalist church that some people have. Mm-hmm. It was a Baptist church, but it was, at least for Baptists, it was fairly moderate to liberal. And so I didn't have a lot of anger. I just kind of let it go because it didn't seem to make sense. But you know, life has a way of working on you, and I did come back to it eventually, to the point of being ordained even. Mm-hmm. But that's how it plays out for the most part, is that it was basically my first real experience in doubt. It really prompted my first experiences of doubt, which came at a very young age. Doubts that I've since reconciled.
Yeah, so, you know, I think I probably have some connections with you there. You know, I grew up a preacher's kid in the Church of Christ, which is for the most part a pretty conservative group. And you know, and at the same time, I was reading all this science and all this kind of, you know, stuff from a pretty young age, and really, you know, began to. I wondered at, you know, at maybe around 12 years old, I was like, am I going to become an atheist because other people who read this stuff are becoming atheists?
Yeah, there's plenty of them.
So that's something that, yeah, like from, I think, a much earlier age than a lot of my peers, I was going through as well. But I never you know, completely separated from it in the way you're describing. I never actually kind of let it go. So I'm curious about the way that it came back to you. What was the door through which?
Well, Well, the way it came back to me had nothing to do really with science. But the way it came back to me was probably a story about as old as any story. And that was that, you know, I went to Furman University, which has a Baptist background, a Southern Baptist background. At the time, it was splitting with the convention. And so it was never like, you know, Bob Jones or something like that. Mm-hmm. But so I was the kid that all the Baptists would like to come and try to convert. You know, I was like a project. And so I would sit in the student center, and they would come around and sit down with me and just, you know, chat for a while. But I knew what was coming. They'd eventually start, you know, find some way to bring up Jesus and some way to bring up, you know, sin and guilt and God and all this stuff. And then I would argue with them, you know, and that was a lot of fun for me because at least in my head, I won every time, you know.
Yeah.
I won the arguments, at least to my satisfaction, I did. And so they could walk away and I could feel kind of smug and happy about that, waiting for the next one. It was kind of like a game for me, you know. I didn't have really anything personally invested in it. It was just a head game for me, so I played it. But then I met Elizabeth my senior year. And, you know, she was a Christian, but she didn't play the game with me. And, you know, when she looked at me, I had sort of a persona. I was in a lot of rock bands and I kind of had long hair and kind of had this persona, you know, of the freaky rock musician. But she like something about it. She just basically looked right through it. And, she saw me and that kind of freaked me out. And she never wanted to argue with me, which kind of pissed me off, you know, because I wanted to argue because I could do that.
Yeah.
And so, but the thing is, we really hit it off. I mean, we really hit it off. And so for about 9 months, we went back and forth about it because we both thought it was important enough to argue about. I mean, not about the details of it, but could we go out and have a serious relationship with these differences? That's what we would argue about. And after about 9 months of that, I started to pray again. And so it wasn't long until I was going back to church again. And so it was really through my wife. That was 25 years ago, 26 years ago. So it was really her and the fact that she didn't bother to play my game. She just loved me, you know. So it was the same old story. Somebody loved me into it. And from there, I had a little toehold, you know, and started climbing back into it. And, you know, but, you know, what I don't address in the book very much was that, you know, the real doubt started at that point. What I was dealing with before with science and God and all that, I mean, it was definitely doubt of some variety, but the real doubt, the real struggle and doubt didn't come until I was, you know, already committed to it.
Wow.
I have a way of, you know, maybe I'm my own worst enemy. I don't know. But that's sort of the story. It was Elizabeth, my wife, that brought me back to Christianity.
That's, you know, that's interesting because in your, you know, in the things I've seen that you've written, you talk about this, that in Christianity, God is incarnational and not conceptual.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, I think that's something that we miss when we do these kind of analysis of religion or, you know, we talk about, we don't start with the experience, start with maybe kind of a metaphysical concept and kind of try to work our way somewhere.
Some general principle abstraction. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's an important, insight that I don't know how to bring it to bear, but I think it's really significant that, you know, none of the people, none of our spiritual predecessors, came to their, you know, perception on God through conceptual metaphysics, right? Like Abraham doesn't, you know, argue his way into a metaphysical position on God. He has certain kinds of experiences that lead him in a certain direction.
That's right.
And so I think there's something to be said for bringing it back through that lens to really kind of understand what's going on. Or to start being able to talk about these subjects better.
Right. I think so too. And I think that people get alienated from the discussion because it's so heady.
Yeah.
People lose interest. I mean, you know, your average person who's not a specialist loses interest pretty quickly in things like, you know, science and religion, you know, that topic, because it's just like, who can know? I mean, there's so much to know.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that by reversing it and starting with, you know, you sitting in the chair, me sitting in the chair is the place to bear fruit. It's going to bear fruit that way, I think.
You know, what you mentioned there, the sounds like the first kind of step for you back into religion was to start praying again.
It was to start praying again.
And you know, that kind of reminds me. Are you familiar with Mike McCarg?
No, sorry to say.
Yeah, so he goes by the moniker Science Mike.
And Science Mike. Yes, I don't follow or know much about, but I've heard the name. Yeah.
So he talks about the significance of praying, and he, you know, he's kind of in a space where he, you know, he doesn't make any kind of metaphysical claims, but he nevertheless has a kind of active faith, and he talks about the science that kind of supports how much prayer really does for us.
Okay.
So, you know, even if you don't, you know, in a particular moment have a lot of belief or a strong belief that there is someone out there, just the act of praying, has all kinds of beneficial effects.
Yes. Right. Right.
And so, you know, that's interesting, from that perspective, but because I think a lot of people can resonate with that. And it seems like you had a similar experience, that this was part of the way that you kind of spun back up into.
Yeah. Well, praying calmed me down a little bit.
Yeah.
Calmed me down. And I think I could say that it, you know, it helped to shut down the debating team in my head.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It helped to just quiet the voices in my head and to make me more aware of the present. You know, like meditation, I guess, would do for somebody who practices that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, kind of on a transhumanist tangent, one thing that a lot of transhumanists talk about is how to increase their brain power or, you know, how to make themselves more intelligent. And one of the things that I've heard is, you know, there are three really, really proven ways to do that. One is exercise, diet, and the third is prayer or meditation.
Huh.
And so, yeah, there seems to be something there that we, you know, are drawn to as a practical matter. But even in that practical matter, you know, like wants to kind of look beyond itself. Like that's how it works.
Right. Yeah. It points away to something else.
Yeah.
Whether that something else can be, you know, demonstrated directly, it points to something else.
Yeah.
I agree.
So how do you deal with that? Because in the kind of in the discussion you're at, you're trying to take a different angle on things, but you're right at the center of a bunch of people saying, you know, things like, okay, but there's no proof for the existence of a God, or that's you know, self-contradictory, or science disproves that, or you know, how do you address that sort of question from the, you know, the angle that we're more familiar with, you know?
Well, you know, I mentioned this in the book. If you want to, here's my quick answer to that. That's obviously a huge question, but my quick answer to that is this, and variations on this theme. I've been in a 12-step group for 12 years, and I had, you know, an addiction, and it almost killed me. Hmm. And one of the things you do in a 12-step group, of course, right there in step two, is you talk about a higher power. And, you know, the thing about that is that it really does work. And, you know, if you want a sheerly sort of a before and after pragmatic, this is the effect, sort of a picture, you know, an addict before and an addict after. If you ask the addict how they recover, they'll talk about a higher power. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't make much sense, and it doesn't really work without that. So what I have come to experience in the last 12 years is a very real sense of a presence. Okay. And that, you know, describe it how I will, you know, a love, a something that I'm almost like I'm aware of, you know, on good days, I'm very aware of it. I'm aware of, you know, the presence of what I call God. And I'm grateful for it. And it has changed, you know, if I didn't believe in that higher power, in what I call God, I'm not sure I'd be alive. And so, you know, whatever proof you want to offer, I think that's as good as anything. I had a discussion about this on my website with a friend that likes to argue with me, and he you know he basically his position was basically a new atheist position, which is that, you know, God cannot be demonstrated. There's no rigorous, you know, you're not rigorous enough about it. And I told him I'm not interested in being rigorous about it. You know, all I need to do is look at my own story, and that I was an addict and now I'm recovered, and my experience is that. That has come about because of the presence of God, and that to me is as convincing as anything. And that's all I can do is, you know, I'm not really interested in arguments about God's existence. Not anymore. I think I might have used to been, but I'm not anymore. They just kind of bore me, and they don't go anywhere. And you know, I'm 47, and I'm like, you know what, my life has been changed, and. That works for me. And all I can actually do with you or anyone else is just tell my story. And, you know, that's what I've got. So, but I do, as a matter of fact, on my good days, feel the presence of God. I experience that, you going back to that experience idea. And on the days when I don't experience that, on the days when I try to push that away, those are the days that I come close to, you know, losing it and returning to my old behavior. So, you know, you tell me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people, find themselves in a similar sort of situation where this, you know, this is a required element in their life, you know, and they've tried being without it and things don't work.
And I can tell you too, that, you know, Nadia Bolz-Weber was asked this question once about, you know, talking about being an atheist, and she said what I say, which is that, you know, I wish I could pull it off. Yeah. I wish I could legitimately pull off being an atheist, because some ways it'd be, you know, I tried and I can't do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, I just can't follow through with it.
Yeah.
So I'm really if I do away with my idea of God, I'm really fighting against myself.
Yeah, actually, you know, a comment you made, I think I saw on your blog struck me. You said self-deception goes a lot of different ways.
Yeah, right.
And
that was in that discussion with Phil, my friend from Japan, who I'm always arguing with.
Yeah. So that's an interesting thought because you know, that's the kind of obvious jab to make at a religious believer is to say, okay, well, you're deceiving yourself. You're
right.
You're living in this kind of, you know, false, belief system that you know is not true, but you're creating this, this
just
false
to make
reality.
You feel better or whatever.
Yeah. And your kind of point stuck out to me because, you're saying, well, pretending that I didn't think this way or didn't believe this or didn't feel this would also be a self-deception.
That's exactly what I was trying to say. Yeah.
That, it would be. Yeah.
For me, it would be. It would absolutely be.
Yeah. And that's, I think, tweeted this the other day. They said, you know, I am inescapably a theist.
Yeah.
And I think that's true for me as well. You know, you can kind of strip away all the details but that's still there. You know, everything for me, almost everything else is up for debate or, yeah, you know, whatever. But I can't really escape that.
Right.
That feeling.
So it's a matter of being true to, you know, myself as well as I know myself. Mm-hmm. It's just simply a matter of being true to my convictions.
Yeah. So tell me, okay. So, you know, I think when these kinds of discussions happen, the big thing that comes up is, you know, traditionally kind of creation versus evolution. But if we zoom out a bit,
yeah,
there's the maybe a deeper question, which is, Does the story of the cosmos, does the story of the universe as we understand it through science, have any correspondence or relationship to the story that we get through our scriptures? Do those sync up? Are they contradictory? Are they pointing in two different directions? What's your perspective on that?
Well, by that question, do you mean, you know, the creation narrative, or do you mean the overall arc of the gospel, I mean, of scripture?
We could go both ways with that, because those are both interesting. But I think even just the perspective of saying, okay, well, if we take the idea that we've been, you know, that our universe has been here for 13 billion years,
yeah,
and you know, what's even the significance of something that's happened in the last few thousand years, or how do we even, you know, make sense of that? So I think both of those angles, you know, both the specifics of like what do the creation stories mean, and you know, does our religion even have a meaning in this kind of larger perspective?
Yeah, well, it's tempting to say no. I think that would be my perspective that I would have taken back when I was in college. Mm-hmm. That the universe seems on the face of it so opposed to the very anthropocentric view, mm-hmm, of the Bible. And on the face of it, I think you know, the answer is that they're contradictory. But I don't think really. I think that the, you know, to take the biblical narrative, I think most Bible scholars would agree with me that the story of Genesis, say, is about our relationship to God. It's not about what, you know, what you would have seen if you had had a video camera, you know, there, mm-hmm, you know, at creation. I think it's more a theological statement. You know, I know some people try to sync up somehow, you know, six days of creation with six epochs of, you know, cosmic history. That to me just seems that turns the Bible into some kind of secret code book, and I just don't think that's what it is. You know, the larger picture of the Bible, you know, the greater arc, you know, which is, in my mind, the Bible is about, you know, it's about moving from alienation to reconciliation, basically. You know, and that's harder for me to say. I don't think that it's opposed to the, you know, to cosmic history. In my book, I take kind of a process theology take toward creation. I kind of take the view that the future is open, that God has created out of material, you know, that has been there, and is, God does not have absolute power in the sense that we think about absolute power. So that if God were to create us as we are today, or any other creature as they are today, the process of evolution would have had to have occurred. God could not simply zap us into being, for whatever reason. I just don't think that that's really a plausible option. So I guess what I'm trying to get at here, and I hope that it gets somewhere close, lands somewhere near your question, is that I can kind of see in cosmic history and in the arrow of, you know, human evolution, kind of a motion towards reconciliation and a motion towards, you know, heaven, I guess, to use a, I don't want to sound too hackneyed, but something like heaven, you know. Yeah. I think there is some progression. I think there is some motion in a certain direction. Evolutionists argue about that.
Yeah.
But from a Christian point of view, yeah, I think there's some motion towards reconciliation with God and with each other. I think that things, in some senses, really do get better, yeah, and have been getting better.
Yeah, so it kind of sounds like you're suggesting that there is, that God, rather than kind of just dictating the course of everything, is kind of engaged in this
yes.
back and forth process.
That's right.
And sort of evoking something out of it.
Yeah, I'm not a pantheist at all, but I do think that God is somehow internally related to the cosmos. Mm.
So that's interesting because it kind of maps to how the Bible presents God's relationship with us, which is at least as I understand it, which is that God calls us towards things and draws us towards things and tries to in essence lure us towards
right.
towards right. making the right choices instead of just kind of putting his fist down and making
right.
everything
yeah.
be a certain way.
The process theologians would say there's no coercion.
Yeah.
There's no coercion. There's no manipulation going on.
Even just from a sort of expressive point of view, the scriptures are always using these kinds of organic metaphors for mm-hmm. how people spiritually change and progress and so forth. And it's whether it's the kind of flowing of the spirit like water
or yeah, right.
or wind or whatever other kind of metaphor is used, it always is, it's always this kind of moving thing. It's motion
right.
rather than that kind of coercive force.
Yeah, and of course in the parables, the kingdom of God is, a mustard seed or yeast in bread. It's something that's organic and starts small and grows.
Yeah.
It's always something that's changing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what?
That's one thing I think. I just wanted to say this while I'm on this point, is that if we could use one word to describe the cosmos, it is the word evolving. Science will change in the next 100 or 200 or 500 years, but I think that in another 1,000 years, we're still going to look at the universe as an evolving thing. I think that's really not going to change. And so these metaphors of change and growth are very, when referring to Christian ideas, are very helpful in a cosmos like that.
Yeah. So what do you think, kind of on our particular niche here, what do you think, you've talked about kind of, there seems to be progress. So what might that turn into in the future? Where might we go from here?
Gosh, I don't know. That's an excellent question. I think that despite all the challenges, my hope is that, one day that we from a purely physical plane, that we will, colonize a solar system or whatever, or that we will move out off the Earth. I think that, saying that we won't or can't do that is ignoring a lot of just the historical trends. So on a purely physical level, I'd say that, I see us doing that. No, not in my lifetime, maybe not even in my grandkids' lifetime, but I think it'll happen. Spiritually, I don't know. It's hard to say. I think that if you step back and look at history, I think that history has been a series of, walls coming down between people. Small tribes, different factions, all the way up to today, the East meets West, etc. I think that those walls will continue to come down, but it's going to be a long, painful process.
Yeah.
And so I hope that there's reconciliation, across religions and across cultures and ethnicities and so forth. But, in the long term, spiritually, I don't know. I don't know what to say to that. So far, if you compare us now to what we looked like, 2 million years ago, Lord knows where it'll go. And when you throw technology and culture into the mix, I just can't say.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm not really sure that my faith really gives me an answer for that. I think it's going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
I think good wins, as you put in that essay that you wrote recently. I think good does win. It's not obvious. I think eventually good will win. But that's all I can say. That's the only thing my faith really tells me.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, I think for me that's that idea that good wins, that there is some kind of progress, even if it's slow, even if it runs backwards at some points. That idea that, you know, at some level things are still moving forward in a positive direction is kind of fundamental. You know, it's
yeah, I think it's fundamental. And if it weren't that way, I think we'd all just lose hope.
Yeah. And, you know, and this, I think, is, for me, this idea of, you know, reconciliation, of dropping the walls between different groups of people. I think, you know, I don't know, I might be wrong about this, but for me, the ability to conceive of a different future mm-hmm. is one of the prime enablers of that. Because once we can kind of look out to the future and say, you know what, we could envision a different situation between our different groups.
Yeah.
Then we have the ability to kind of loosen our grip on the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, you know, for me, it's so so telling that, you know, Martin Luther King's most famous line is "I have a dream."
Oh, right. Of course.
Because he's doing the same thing that the biblical prophets do.
Mm-hmm.
He uses that kind of biblical language of justice rolling on like a mighty river and so forth. He's evoking a better future. He's calling people to envision and imagine a better future and using that as a tool to say, okay, now we can loosen our grip on the mm-hmm. concrete dividers between us. Right.
The things that are fear. Yeah.
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 Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. So, yeah, that's a big thing, obviously, for me. It's something I keep coming back to.
It's Martin Luther's his famous phrase about the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that some kind of similar thought process has inspired so many people in history to do, you know, these incredible things, to take incredible risks and be incredibly courageous.
Mm-hmm.
Because just like with, you know, kind of zooming out and getting a bigger perspective on the cosmos, like being able to say, you know what, the future could be different, enables us to not be as fearful in the things that we're facing right now.
Yeah, yeah, but you've really got to believe it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's and true. He really believed it. MLK really believed it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, I don't know. So what, you know, kind of on our bigger picture view of the universe and of the cosmos, what does this do to our image of God if we, you know, suddenly realize, okay, there are stars beneath me as well as above me.
Mm.
This whole thing is much bigger than I ever really might have conceived of on my own. What is that? How does that change the way we think about God or relate to God even?
Well, I think that it, you know, in the book of Job, one of the things that the tendency is, I'll get back to Job in a second, but the tendency is to look at the scale of the universe and time and space and say, well, we just don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
We're just too small, you know. And this was the fear that struck me when I was about 8 or 9 or 10 years old, is that, you know, when I started getting a sense of the scale of things in space and time, I just thought, well, you know, it's just so big, we could not, how could we possibly matter?
Yeah.
In the book of Job, what God does with Job, of course, is he takes him on a tour of, you know, God takes Job on a tour of the cosmos and takes him out to the fringes of Job's knowledge, you know, out to the very edge of the cosmos as Job knew it, places from which human civilization itself looked pretty small and inconsequential. And I think I think the real lesson though is not that we're inconsequential. I think when God was finished speaking with Job, Job didn't walk away thinking that Job was inconsequential. I think Job saw that God maybe had concerns outside of humanity, that there were other things going on in the cosmos besides humanity. But I think what really happened is that Job found himself within the cosmos that God loves. you know. He found himself within the cosmos that Job that God loves, and that gave him a great sense of levity. That gave him a great sense of levity, and I think the same thing can happen to us. So it's not that we're inconsequential or that we're tiny, but it's that we belong. You know, that we actually do belong here. This is our home, and we belong in the cosmos, just like, you know, Leviathan does when God shows Job Leviathan, or just like the ostrich does, or just like the vulture does, you know, yeah. That we have our own place here. And we're not the only thing in the universe, but we do have our place, and we do belong here.
Yeah, that's really amazing. I've not really thought about Job from that perspective before, but
there's a lot going on in that book.
Yeah, there is.
It really is a lot. It's a really confounding book, but there's a lot of great stuff in there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a essentially huge and in-depth book, you know, these long kind of I guess it's dialogues, but you know, yep. It's almost like you know, it makes me think of like a Shakespearean play when you read it.
Yeah, right, know? right. It's basically like a play. Yeah, it really is, very much is.
And yeah, and just it's back and forth, and you know, all these different kinds of viewpoints being presented. But it's, you know, the book of Job stands out as one of the you know, most kind of monumental works of early human literature.
Right, right. It's probably the oldest story in the Bible.
Yeah.
You know, maybe not the form exactly that it's come to us in, but the story itself is one of the oldest, is probably the oldest one in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wrestles with these concepts in such a sophisticated way.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. It goes quite deep. It really does.
Yeah,
and what we learned in Sunday school about Job is that Job was a good man, and then all these bad things happened to him, and then God made it better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what you get is the prose at the beginning and the end. You know, we've been to quote a colleague's phrase, we've been Sunday schooled into thinking that Job is basically about, you know, what happens at the beginning and the ending of the book, but what's really going on in Job is all the stuff in the middle.
Yeah.
The dialogue, you know, the poetry.
Mm-hmm.
My seminary professor called it Israel goes to the theater. You know, it's, yeah. it's out of the normal stream of the Bible. You know, you're going into this place and you're just watching this show, and when you leave, you can't be the same again. You know, it's changed you, and it's, you know, it's completely out of space and time because it's not set in Israel. These are not Israelites that we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and it's set, you know, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, kind of.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. It's that makes me, you know, I think people misunderstand how to read the Bible so much. And part of it is because Sunday school gives us such a kind of caricatured view of the Bible. But when we, you know, because when we do engage with it, it is Shakespeare. It's not... not these just a series of fables where you kind of, you know, learn an important lesson at the end of the day.
Yeah, it will work at whatever level we come to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. I think it's great when we can use the scriptures as a way of expanding our vision and our imagination. And I think it's great when we can use science as a way of expanding our vision and imagination. And I love that you have connected those things. So your book comes out, I think, at the beginning of March. Is that right?
That's right, March 1st.
So, but you can pre-order it right now
at Amazon. That's right.
Okay.
And so, it's less than $10 right now.
All right. So yeah. I'll put a link to it in our show notes.
Okay. Great.
For people. But where else can they follow you or find out more information about what you're working on?
My website is psnt.net.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I do most of my writing. Occasionally, I put something up on Huffington Post or something like that. But most of my writing I like to do, I used to like to use art and videos and stuff like that. So I just put it up on my own website.
Awesome. All right. Well, we'll look for that. And definitely love the title of the book. Look forward to reading it. And thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for talking to me today, Micah.
All right. We'll see you later.
Bye-bye.